All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're diving into a fascinating and really influential period in American religious history, 19th century American evangelicalism.
Yeah, and you shared some excerpts from a really interesting lecture series on American Christianity, focusing specifically on the Black Church and then moving into the 19th century and the rise of evangelicalism. And for this deep dive, we're zeroing in on the lives and impact of two of the biggest names of that movement, Charles Grandison Finney and Dwight L. Moody.
That's right. So this lecture is actually part of a larger course. It covers a lot of ground. But we really want to understand the key figures and the characteristics, you know, the DNA of this movement that really transformed American Christianity. And we're going to approach this, like you said, through a biographical lens, starting today with Finney and using his story as a window into this whole era.
Okay, so Charles Grandison Finney, born in 1792 in Warren, Connecticut.
And his family moved early on to Adams, New York, which is a pretty interesting place, historically speaking.
Yeah, Adams is right in the heart of what became known as the Burnt Over District.
I always loved that name, the Burnt Over District.
Yeah, it's such a striking image, and it really captures the intensity of the religious fervor in that area of upstate New York during that time. It wasn't actually burnt over by any fires, but rather by this constant succession of revivals and new religious groups springing up. It was like the spiritual ground had been completely exhausted, like it had been burnt over by all the religious activity.
I mean, we've talked before about how groups like the early Mormons and the Shakers had their roots right in this area.
Right, exactly. And Finney's activities would only add to that, that kind of ongoing religious dynamism of the region.
So in Adams, around 1818, Finney starts studying law. Seems like a pretty straight-laced path, right?
Yeah, on the surface, you'd think so.
But then in 1821, not too far from Adams, he has this experience that completely changes everything, this huge, dramatic conversion experience. He describes it as this incredibly powerful encounter with God, one that completely reoriented his life and set him on a path toward ministry.
It's amazing to think about these moments, these turning points in people's lives. And I think it's worth noting that Finney's legal training, even though he didn't actually become a lawyer, probably really helped him later on.
How so?
Well, think about it. All those skills he developed, rhetoric, argumentation, logical thinking, those are all super valuable for a preacher, especially one who's trying to persuade people and present a compelling case for their faith.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that connection.
After his conversion, he didn't immediately jump into preaching, though.
No.
No, he actually sought out this local Presbyterian minister for guidance and mentorship. He really wanted to make sure he had a solid theological foundation before he started preaching. And eventually he was ordained in the Presbyterian Church.
You know, I actually got to visit Adams, New York myself.
Yeah. Oh,
it was
back
in 1992 for the bicentennial of Finney's birth.
Wow, that must have been something.
It was. They had this whole conference there. Adams is such a small town. Like, I think it has one stoplight, but the whole town really turned out for this conference.
So what was it like being there?
It was amazing. Being in that environment, you know, where Finney had such a profound experience, it just made his story come alive in a totally different way. We had one session in the church where he had studied, and then the last session was actually held outdoors, really close to the spot where he had his conversion. Pretty powerful stuff.
I bet. And, you know, after his ordination, Finney really hit the ground running.
He did. He became this incredibly successful itinerant evangelist, traveling around, preaching at different churches, holding these huge revival meetings.
Yeah, he really tapped into something. And this is where we get into some really interesting discussions among historians about how to categorize his work.
Right. Is it a continuation of the Second Great Awakening? Or is it something totally new, a so-called Third Great Awakening? Sometimes people specifically call it the Finneyite revivals.
Exactly. It's an ongoing debate. Some historians argue that Finney's revivals were really just a later phase of the Second Great Awakening.
They see it as like one continuous wave of religious fervor.
Yeah, but others, myself included, see Finney's revivals as distinct, like a whole new wave.
A Third Great Awakening.
Exactly. And one of the things that makes me lean towards that interpretation is that there seems to be kind of a lull in major revival activity between the peak of the Second Great Awakening and then, boom, you have Finney coming onto the scene.
It's like a new surge of energy. And he wasn't limited to the United States either. He actually spent 2 years in England from 1857 to 1858, where he continued to preach and hold these huge revival meetings.
Yeah, and that really highlights this important thing happening in the 19th century, this kind of back and forth exchange of preachers and ideas between England and America, you know, this transatlantic revivalism.
It's like a spiritual pipeline across the ocean.
Exactly. George Whitefield in The First Great Awakening is an early example of this, but it really picks up steam in the 19th century. People like Finney and later Dwight L. Moody.
And this exchange really points to something bigger, I think. This sense of a shared evangelical identity that's developing across the Atlantic.
Totally. They were sharing ideas, methods, theological understandings, and it's all contributing to the growth of this distinct evangelical movement.
And in 1835, in the midst of all this rival activity, Finney takes on a new role. He becomes the first professor of theology at Oberlin College.
And later, he actually served as the president of Oberlin from 1851 to 1866.
And Oberlin College, it's got to be said, is a hugely important institution in American history. For a bunch of reasons.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It was incredibly progressive for its time.
It was founded as an abolitionist institution, the first college in America, with abolition of slavery as part of its core mission. And Finney, being the staunch abolitionist he was, he used Oberlin as a major center for the anti-slavery movement.
For Finney, there was absolutely no separation between preaching the gospel and working for social justice. He saw them as deeply interconnected.
Yeah, and that's really striking when you compare it to some later forms of evangelicalism, which sometimes have had a more complicated relationship with social activism.
Right. It's a significant distinction. And Oberlin's progressiveness didn't stop there. It also became the first co-educational institution in the United States. They admitted men and women from the very beginning.
Another groundbreaking move. That was huge for women's access to higher education, which, of course, had massive ripple effects on their roles in society, ministry, and even social reform movements.
It really did change the game, and it also paved the way for women like Antoinette Brown.
Right. She was the first woman in the U.S. to receive a degree in theology, and she graduated from Oberlin.
She faced a lot of resistance, though. Getting ordained as a woman in the mainline denominations back then was basically impossible. But she eventually found a home in the Unitarian Church, which was much more open to women in ministry. Her story alone is fascinating. It really highlights all the obstacles that women in ministry were facing in the 19th century.
It's a whole other deep dive waiting to happen.
Totally. But let's get back to Oberlin for a second. In addition to all of that, it was also a center for teaching Finney's theology of revivalism. I mean, his whole understanding of how revivals work and how they can be fostered, it was baked into the curriculum at Oberlin.
And it was a place where they really emphasized the doctrine of sanctification or holiness. A lot of that emphasis came from the theology of John Wesley, the founder of Methodism.
Right. So for those who might not be familiar with those terms, Wesley basically saw the Christian life as having two main stages, justification and sanctification.
Okay. Break that down for us.
So justification is basically being made right with God, but being declared righteous in God's sight. And that's based on faith in Jesus Christ.
Gotcha.
And then sanctification is the process of becoming more and more holy, more Christ-like in your character and actions, an ongoing process. And Wesley really emphasized the idea of purity of heart as a key sign of this sanctifying work.
Okay, so that's Wesley's view.
Right. And Finney built on that understanding of sanctification, but with a slightly different emphasis. For Wesley, it was all about purity of heart. But Finney, he tended to focus more on the empowering work of the Holy Spirit in enabling believers to live out their faith and engage in ministry.
So for Finney, sanctification was less about being perfect and more about being empowered for action.
Exactly. The lecture even mentions that Finney would hold these holiness meetings in a tent right on Oberlin's campus. And this tent had a sign that said, "Holiness unto the Lord." It's just a really vivid picture of what the atmosphere must have been like back then. This real emphasis on striving for Christian perfection.
It sounds intense.
It was. But Oberlin wasn't all about, intense spiritual striving. They were actually really ahead of their time in terms of their focus on health and well-being. They encouraged students to eat healthy, exercise regularly, and live a balanced lifestyle.
So that's pretty forward-thinking for the 19th century.
Totally. And, when you take all of that together, the abolitionism, the co-education, the emphasis on holiness, the focus on health, it just makes Oberlin this really unique and hugely important place in the story of American Christianity.
Absolutely. Now, alongside all of his work at Oberlin, Finney also wrote this book that became incredibly influential, Lectures on Revivals of Religion.
Oh, yeah. That book was a total blockbuster.
It was. People were devouring it, not just in America, but in England, too.
Mm.
Even Catherine Booth, who co-founded the Salvation Army, was a huge fan.
That says a lot.
And the reason this book was so popular and so influential was because it really laid out Finney's approach to conducting revivals. And it introduced what became known as his new measures.
these were like his kind of revolutionary techniques for leading people to Christ and sparking spiritual awakening.
Exactly. And these new measures, they weren't just random ideas. They were rooted in Finney's evolving theological perspective.
Right. Specifically, his move towards a more Arminian understanding of salvation.
And for folks who maybe aren't up on their theological jargon, Arminianism basically emphasizes human agency, free will, and the ability of individuals to choose to respond to God's grace.
It's a contrast to Calvinism, which emphasizes God's sovereignty and predestination.
Right. And so the very first of Finney's new measures was all about setting up the conditions for revival. He didn't think people should just passively wait for God to move. He believed that they could and should actively cultivate an environment where revival was more likely to happen.
He was like, let's not just pray for revival, let's create the conditions that make it possible.
Exactly. And another of his new measures was holding unseasonable hours for religious services.
Yeah, he was all about making church accessible to working people.
Right. So instead of just the traditional Sunday morning services, he suggested holding meetings at noon when factory workers could attend during their lunch breaks, or evening meetings after the workday was over.
Very practical.
Very. He also pioneered the idea of protracted meetings, which were these extended revival meetings that could last for days or even weeks.
These were basically like bringing the camp meeting experience into the city.
Right. And these extended gatherings, they really helped foster a sense of community and allowed people to really dive deep into spiritual matters.
Finney was also a big believer in using colloquial language in his preaching.
Oh, yeah. He didn't want to talk over people's heads. He wanted to connect with them where they were at.
He used everyday language, you know, avoided all that fancy theological jargon. It was all about communicating the gospel message in a way that people could understand and relate to. And by the way, his sermons could sometimes go on for 2 hours.
2 hours.
I know. But it shows you how passionate he was and how much he believed in the importance of what he was preaching.
Absolutely. Now, one of Finney's more, shall we say, controversial new measures was specifically naming individuals in his prayers and sermons.
Especially those who were known for their less than saintly behavior.
Yeah, he would call people out by name. Can you imagine that happening in a church today?
People would probably walk out.
I know. But Finney, he believed that this kind of direct confrontation was a powerful way to shake people out of their complacency and encourage them to repent.
Whether you agree with his methods or not, you got to admire his boldness.
Absolutely. Finney also introduced inquiry meetings after his sermons, which were basically opportunities for people who were feeling convicted or had questions about their faith to talk to someone and get guidance.
It was like a proto-altar call.
Right. And then there was the famous anxious bench, which started out as just a pew where people could sit if they were feeling, you know, anxious about their salvation.
Yeah.
But Finney actually turned it into a place where people could come forward and kneel in prayer, often called the mercy seat or the penitent form.
This is actually pretty significant because it's a practice that you still see in a lot of Pentecostal and Wesleyan holiness churches today.
Really?
Yeah. And while those traditions might have had similar practices before Finney, he really helped popularize and formalize this idea of people coming forward to publicly express their desire for salvation.
And then another one of his new measures that was super controversial at the time, he encouraged women to testify and pray out loud in public church meetings.
Which was radical for the time.
Super radical. Remember, this is a time when women were largely excluded from any kind of formal leadership roles in most churches.
But Finney was a firm believer in the spiritual gifts of women. And he thought that they should be able to share their faith publicly.
Yeah, he was drawing on the precedent set by John Wesley in the Methodist movement, which was much more open to women's participation in ministry.
And this was a big step forward in terms of challenging the traditional gender roles in the church.
Huge step. And then finally, Finney also implemented this practice of sending out bands of workers to visit homes after his revival meetings.
So these were teams of dedicated folks who would go and visit people who had expressed interest in Christianity or had recently converted.
It was all about providing support, encouragement, and discipleship for new believers.
Basically, follow-up was key for Finney. He didn't want to just preach and then move on. He wanted to make sure that people were being cared for and nurtured in their faith.
So when you look at all of these new measures together, it's really clear that they reflect Finney's theological shift toward Arminianism. They're all about empowering individuals to choose Christ and to actively participate in their own spiritual growth.
Exactly. He wasn't just tinkering with church practices. He was operating from a different understanding of how salvation works.
And these powerful revivals that Finney was leading, they had a significant impact beyond the individual conversions they produced.
Right. One of the big consequences was the rise of these voluntary societies.
Yeah, these groups were popping up all over the place.
Yeah.
And they were fueled by the energy and enthusiasm generated by the revivals.
They were focused on all sorts of causes, missions, education, social reform, you name it.
And one of the really interesting things about these societies is that they were often interdenominational.
Yeah, you'd have Baptists working alongside Methodists and Presbyterians, all coming together for a common cause.
Which was pretty remarkable at a time when denominational divisions were still pretty strong.
It was, and it really fostered this sense of a broader Protestant identity.
These societies also placed a huge emphasis on the importance of preaching and on the doctrine of disinterested benevolence.
Now that's a mouthful.
It is. But basically it means moving from selfishness to selflessness. It's about putting the needs of others ahead of your own.
It was a call to live a life of active compassion and service as a direct result of your conversion experience.
And this idea, it really fueled the social reform movements of the time.
Absolutely. It provided a theological justification for things like abolitionism and the push for women's rights.
Yeah, people were saying, look, if we're truly transformed by Christ, then we have to care about the well-being of others. We can't just sit back and ignore injustice.
And both Finney and Moody were really concerned about what happens after conversion.
Right. They didn't want people's faith to just stagnate. They wanted to see it translate into action.
So to sum up Finney's legacy, he was a truly remarkable figure.
He really was. The lecture quotes someone as saying that Finney was an immensely important man in American history by any standard.
And I think that's spot on. I mean, his revivals were a major force in the anti-slavery movement. He helped shape the landscape of urban evangelism, and he really made evangelicalism a force to be reckoned with in the public sphere.
He was a public theologian in the truest sense of the word.
He was. And he left a lasting impact on both the church and the broader American culture.
Okay, so that's Charles Grandison Finney, an absolute giant in American religious history. Now the lecture moves on to the second major figure we're looking at, Dwight L. Moody, born in 1837 in Northfield, Massachusetts.
And even his birthplace is significant in the history of American Christianity.
It is. The lecture makes a point of saying that Northfield is a place to remember.
Now Moody's early life was pretty tough. His father died when he was only 4, leaving his mother to raise 9 kids on her own. And they faced some serious financial struggles.
And another really important thing about his background, he was raised in a Unitarian family.
Which meant that he didn't have that traditional Protestant upbringing.
Yeah, no early exposure to the kinds of evangelical teachings that he would later become known for.
Right. He had to find his own way to those beliefs later in life.
Exactly. At age 17, Moody leaves Northfield and heads for the big city, Boston. He gets a job working in his uncle's shoe store. And it's there, in that shoe store, that his life takes a dramatic turn.
It's a great story.
It is. So he's working in this shoe store, and he meets this Sunday school teacher named Edward Kimball, who also works for his uncle.
And the lecture specifically calls him a faithful Sunday school teacher.
Yeah, highlighting the idea that even these seemingly ordinary acts of ministry can have a huge impact.
Totally. It's a reminder that sometimes the most influential people in our lives are those who are just quietly and consistently living out their faith.
And this encounter with Edward Kimball, it leads to Moody's conversion.
And there's actually a historical marker in Boston that commemorates this event. It says that D.L. Moody, the famous evangelist and founder of the Northfield schools, experienced his conversion in a shoe store on that very spot, April 21st, 1855.
Really?
Yeah. And if you ever go to Boston, you can actually find this plaque. It's near the British State House and this tea shop with the big kettle out front.
I love those little details that connect these big historical figures to specific places.
Me too. It makes history come alive.
Absolutely. So Moody converts in a shoe store. You'd think the next logical step would be to join a church, right?
You would. But it wasn't quite that straightforward for Moody. He actually ran into some trouble trying to become a church member.
Interesting.
Yeah. And that's a part of his story that we'll have to explore in more detail next time.
Okay, so let's recap. We've talked about Charles Grandison Finney. His life, his impact, his new measures. He really was a pivotal figure in shaping the course of American evangelicalism.
Totally. He helped to make evangelicalism a major force in American society.
And we've started to explore the early life of Dwight L. Moody and his dramatic conversion experience in a Boston shoe store.
Next time, we'll delve deeper into Moody's story and see how he picked up the torch of 19th century evangelicalism and ran with it.
It's fascinating to see how both of these men, Finney and Moody, were so deeply committed to the idea that faith should lead to action.
They really believed that the gospel had implications for every area of life.
And that commitment, that passion, it's something that I think we can still learn from today. So as you go about your week, think about this. What are the ways that your faith calls you to engage with the world around you? Are there any new measures that you might need to adopt in order to make your faith more active and more impactful in the 21st century?
That's something for all of us to ponder.
Until next time.
See you then.